We continue this week in week six. Week six, as we reflect on Jesus, and in particular, the idea is victory and freedom and liberation. What did you think about this week's lesson? Did it make any connections? Did it? What did you think about questions about oppression and liberating victory? Well, maybe no one did. Okay. You know, we don't. Some folks talk more about oppression and liberation than others. And in fact, in back last century, and it still continues today, there's a big movement primarily within Latin America on liberation theology and liberation theologians are very big on trying to overcome oppression, primarily oppression by governments and those kinds of things. And they're involved. A lot of liberation theologians in Latin America and South America are involved in protests against governmental kinds of things. So, are there any things that oppress or hold you back? Okay. Things that hold us back even within ourselves. You got bad friends that hold you back? Okay. Even the bad friends that Paul mentions, bad friends that hold you back, the decision to hang out with them very likely is something that's from within us. Anything in particular that came to mind, Jim, about things within that hold us back? Yeah, failure is one of those, the possibility of failure is one of those things that really holds a lot of folks back. Yes, Paul? Lack of money will hold you back? Absolutely. Other things that might hold you back? Okay. We, Christian speak, Christian talk, a lot of Christian church speak deals with ideas of battle and victory and being liberated. You know, people talk about battles and life is a battle between good and evil. In fact, when we talk about the great battle at the end, a lot of folks talk about that, and we call it Armageddon. In fact, we people will say, well, Armageddon's on the way, or this might be Armageddon. Although what's really interesting is that last battle in the book of Revelation never takes place. It's already been won. That battle's never fought in the book of Revelation. And as Tom and I were at a professional meeting Thursday night, and someone was doing a presentation on a book that one of our theolog colleagues has just published a book on the book of Revelation as a book of hope. And Lawrence was talking about the Battle of Armageddon, you know, at the Hill of Megiddo and the Plain of Megiddo. And Tom made the comment later. He said, well, all those armies can't gather there anyway. It wouldn't hold more than two divisions. I've been there. Yeah, so you can't have all these millions to fight. But the battle never takes place in the book of Revelation. It's already been won by a lamb that was slain. But, you know, we talk a lot about those kinds of things and being liberated and being free. But there's a lot, I mean, if we go through our hymnal, you know, victory in Jesus. That's right. Marching as to war. Yes, Susan. Where were they again in Italy? Right.
So she
said they had to really go out and stuff with them. Well, you do. And there's, and I'm trying to remember now, a couple of years ago, we were talking one night and I had a whole list in the newest Baptist hymnal. It's not those that are being pulled out, but the newest Baptist hymnal that's being produced. It may have just come out recently. They're taking out all kinds of things that talk about servanthood. All kinds of hymns that talk about servanthood. Paul is prime. Yeah, that's Paul. Now, Jesus did make some references, to fighting against powers, etc. But and obviously he fought against powers. But the whole idea of the armor of God and fighting against principalities and powers, that's primarily a Pauline construct. And then, of course, you pick it up with the apocalypse with John. And this came up the other night, I don't think our colleague appreciated a couple of us making comments when he talked about, Antichrist. And I reminded him the only place that the word is used is actually in 1st and 2nd John. And then it's not one Antichrist, it's Antichrists. Multiples. And so, but that whole battle imagery is really more from the idea of Paul in his teachings. But to be liberated, and it talks about victory and liberation in the lesson this week in many different places. Be liberated, we need to claim and believe in freedom, right? To make a change in ourselves. And use that to overcome other forces. Some of those other forces, fear. Does fear hold us back? You've already talked about fear of failure. Do what? Fear of ridicule. That's right. Hatred holds people back. Greed. Pride. In my opinion, one of the biggest, which also feeds into probably a lot of these others, is ignorance. Regularly, colleagues and I talk about, well, let's go see if we can stamp out ignorance today. Or at least put a dent in it. So all of those kinds of things. Paul knew about oppression. And a lot of the discussion about oppression, we really find in Paul's writings. He knew a lot about oppression. He had been an oppressor, had he not? An oppressor par excellence. Even having people killed just for a different belief. And then he knew not just about oppressing others, he knew about being oppressed. And he writes in Galatians chapter 5 and in Colossians about liberating freedom from God. So what does freedom or liberation mean? What does freedom mean? What does liberation mean? Well, for a lot of folks, it is that kind of thing, hey, I'm free to do whatever. In fact, in the letters to the churches of Galatia, Paul really, that's the one of Paul's letters. The only one of Paul's letters that he doesn't give thanks for. In every other letter, there's the opening and then there's a thanksgiving. I thank my God for you in all my prayers, or I thank God that you're doing this, or I thank God that you're doing that. Not the churches of Galatia. He immediately jumps on them with both feet. He's not thankful for them because there are two groups that are warring in that church. Or those churches, it's not just one church, the churches in the area of Galatia. And in that particular letter, he talks about freedom and he talks about being liberated from the law. But then he talks about not using that freedom irresponsibly. You've got two groups there. One of the groups is called the Judaizers, and we've mentioned before, they're predominantly from a strong Hebrew background, very strict Hebrew background, and for them, before you can become a Christian, you have to first become a Jew. You have to submit to circumcision. You have to submit to the law and the sacrifices. And so they accuse Paul when he says you're free from the law. They accuse Paul of trying to blaspheme against God and to get rid of everything and be too liberal. On the other hand, there's another group that I call the anti-legalists that are primarily from a Hellenistic background, whether Hellenistic Jewish or simply Gentile. From a Hellenistic background, I think more Gentile or pagan. And they believe, okay, Christ has set them free. They're free from the law so they can do anything they want to, including if there's a if they happen to come from the cult of Dionysus, which was the Dionysiac cult tied to fertility rites, animals, crops, and Dionysus was a dying and rising god tied to the seasons. But if they came from that and there was a special festival for Dionysus on a Thursday, they had no qualms about, hey, we're going to go here and participate in this and then come back on Sunday and worship with the Christians and then go back again for something else and then come back on Sunday and worship with the Christians. And Paul said, wait a minute, yes, you're free. You're free from being straitjacketed by the law, but you got to use your freedom responsibly. And so both of these groups jump all over Paul and accuse him of not being an apostle, and he's not happy with either one of them. And so he starts reaming them out. So, you know, there is this idea of freedom and liberation, but freedom and liberation is not license. Within Christianity, freedom and liberation is to be free to be all we... There you go with those military slogans again. Be all you can be. To be all we can be, but be all we can be in God, in Christ, not for our own selves. And in the New Testament, freedom, not just in the writings of Paul, but in any New Testament book where freedom is discussed, freedom is always freedom from something, from some sphere of obligation that you have, whether it's the law or something else. Freedom from something and for something else. It's not just to be freed from something. In the New Testament, in the teachings of Jesus, in the teachings of Paul, in the other writings, if you are given freedom, it's always for something else. But then again, in the Old Testament, it's the same thing. God never blesses anybody in any of the biblical stories without expecting responsible action. So any blessing, any freedom, is always to have responsibility for accomplishing something else. We find theologically that freedom in and through, we find freedom in and through Christ, but that freedom also entails an obligation to Jesus as Lord. In fact, Paul will talk about, he identifies freedom in Christ with being a doulos, Greek word for slave. And say, but wait a minute, you're giving up the law and you're going to become a slave to Christ. But he identifies freedom with Christ as being a slave of Christ because salvation is liberation from our former self and oppression. And following the lordship of Christ gives us freedom to accomplish greater things than we ever could before. In fact, as Charles Cosgrove writes in the Mercer Dictionary of the Bible, and I quote, Jesus is Savior only insofar as he is also Lord. End quote. Jesus is Savior only insofar as he is Lord as well. And the freedom and the liberation he gives is not freedom to just go wild. It's freedom from the former self, from the former things that hold us back, whether it's fear or hatred or ignorance or pride or greed or worry or anything else. Those things that really oppress us and oftentimes depress us. In the New Testament, there are several different ways that freedom functions then. First of all, it's freedom from fate. We don't have to worry about fate. Within many of the Gentile traditions, the powers of fate, astrology, astrological kinds of things in the Greco-Roman world held that life was governed by forces out there called fate. Fate, for many of the Greco-Roman philosophies, fate had nothing to do with predeterminism. It was you were at the whims of the gods or whatever the force was out there in the universe. And it wasn't a predestinarian kind of look at fate. And it was very, oftentimes very capricious. Predestination, proorizo in the New Testament, is that the events of life are predetermined ahead of time, even before you're born, and you do not have any say-so in those whatsoever. Well, yes and no. No, yes and no. Some folks do. Others, it doesn't, there's no real rhyme or reason. Even in the Old Testament, there are folks who tried to use predestination to explain the fall with infralapsarianism and superlapsarianism. And in one case, God looked ahead and God looked at all the different possibilities out there as to which one, which predetermined outcome would give the most people the opportunity, and then God chose that. So it's kind of like, okay, well, I'm going to look all, thumbing through, and, well, I like this way better than the others. In the other one, God created people free and then waited to see what they would choose, and when they chose, then God predestined from that point on. So, it's not necessarily rhyme or reason with those kinds of things. So within predeterminism, there is not that kind of thing. Paul speaks of freedom from fate, which doesn't mean freedom from self-determination, but release from any impersonal force. Okay? Release from any impersonal force out there. Fate came around and wasn't necessarily a predeterministic kind of thing. The gods could be very capricious, and fate could be what they decided on any given moment. Different stories of the flood. In the Noah account, you've got its punishment by God on human beings. In the Gilgamesh epic and the Enuma Elish, Babylonian flood stories, it's the capriciousness of the gods in one case, and in another one, the gods decide to break an earthen dam and see what's going to happen. That would not be a predeterministic kind of thing, but that would be fate. That would be considered fate. Another way that freedom is used in the New Testament is freedom from sin. Freedom from sin. We are shackled by sin, and so Christ frees us. He breaks the shackles. He frees us and liberates us from sin. It doesn't exempt us from the struggle with sin. Sin is still there. But it frees us from being shackled and tied to sin in a way that we can't get out. In a way that we can't get out, not on our own. We become active participants in a battle against sin, but we're not doing it by ourselves because Christ has set us free, and if we freely follow Him, then we're active participants along with Him, and He is along with us, trying to get freedom from the consequences of sin.
That
is oppression, and they've got these two warring sides, and they're under that. Mm-hmm. And yes, they have to live with it, but they don't have to be depressed and totally oppressed by it. From Paul's particular standpoint, they can still have that freedom, even under that oppression, the freedom to follow their conscience, the freedom to follow Christ, the freedom not to sin, not to fall into the traps that the two opposing sides. I know it's hard. People think that, follow Jesus. It's so easy. No. Following Jesus is probably the most difficult thing you'll ever do in your life.
And, those Christians that were beheaded, those
Coptic Christians, Egyptian Christians.
We
really haven't. But the interesting thing, if you note the majority of those, as they were being led out and as they were being beheaded, what were they doing? They were testifying and they were praying to God, and they were freed from Yes, I'm sure they were anxious and a little bit scared, but in that connection with God, in that connection with Christ, they were freed from the oppression. Because they proved they were free because they continued to pray, even as they were being beheaded. That it's liberation, but it also it doesn't mean that we don't have to struggle against sin and struggle against oppression. You know, people used to say, "Well, Jesus, I say he didn't promise you a rose garden." I say, "Oh, wrong, he did." And I've told many of y'all this before. Sorry, I'll repeat it again. Our next door neighbors, when I was growing up, had a huge rose garden. It was almost twice the size of this room. All kinds of roses. They didn't end up getting a whole lot of them, except from the fringes, because when they planted that rose garden, they planted the bushes about this far apart. And you know what happens. They grew up and they just all into each other. I mean, I like roses. I really love yellow roses. Some of the prettiest yellow roses. And I've been to Texas a couple of times, but I didn't bring back any yellow roses. But some of the prettiest yellow roses I have ever, ever seen in my life grew almost in the center of that rose garden. They never cut any of those roses. And you know why? Well, they could have, but they didn't want to go through the briars. Right? And as they do what? Do what, Jerry? Yeah. Yep. But, you know, and as a hunter, and you hunters in here know, you can put on, you think you got every place that can get caught by a sawbriar covered, and you start through them and you start chasing a rabbit or you start looking for, you know, an animal, you're going to get stuck. Now you got to decide, am I going to go recover that or am I just going to stand out here and not, and just let it waste? Well, it's the same thing with that rose garden. Am I going to get in there realizing I'm going to get hung up and I'm going to get stuck, but if I get there, I get the prize, the roses, and bring them back out and enjoy them, or am I just going to sit, stand out here and watch them fall apart? So, my analogy is God promised us a rose garden, and the rose garden out there in the center, that's where we're trying to get to. But if we expect to get there without getting snagged, without having to fight against the briars, the oppression, then it's all for naught. So do some Southern Baptists too.
Pastor probably knows what I'm talking about. We're not here to denigrate any other faith in Christ. That's not what I'm talking about.
There's some very strong Coptic Christians.
There is some very strong.
And who are very, very much Christian.
Oh yeah.
But there's some Southern Baptists have some awfully strange ideas that I part company with and have a long time ago. And there's some CBF folks that I part company with on things too. But
just this morning, I talked extensively about the ghetto. So it's almost like you're listening to me at home. But when I typed in Galatians, you just say Galatians 7:10. Our Christ and our God's got the whole world in sense. And I agree. We and I don't always agree. But we're all here to study Christ before and God and believe us one church and one unity. So that's what you're saying.
Well, unity of purpose, but not uniformity of doctrine. And so, you know, we've got this. But in fact, actually, there's a Coptic Christian church in Malden. If y'all been here for 30 some years, Egyptian. It's an Egyptian Christian church. Coptic Christian church actually is a very old church. Church tradition says that John Mark started the Coptic church in and around Alexandria, because tradition says John Mark went there. It's just like tradition says that Thomas ended up in India and was actually martyred in India. And I'm not so sure. I've done some study in some of the Nag Hammadi literature, and I really think a lot of what's in the Nag Hammadi literature, the Gospel of Thomas, the Contender, and some things like that, very much like some Hindu teachings. And if indeed Thomas ended up in India, I can see where there could be a possible blending of that kind of stuff. The Coptic Christian Church, in fact, Mary did a wedding, and it was really kind of strange about a year or so ago. I've mentioned it to a few of you before. She did a wedding at Furman, and part of the reason it was at Furman is because they couldn't get married in either place because the bride was Coptic Christian and the groom was Jewish, and neither was going to convert. So the rabbi, no, you can't get married in the synagogue. The priest at the Coptic church, no, you can't get married here. So they got married, and neither would do it, so they actually got a colleague of mine who's a Baptist did the wedding for them there at Furman. But, you know, we've got this then freedom from sin is freedom over passions and freedom with truth and ethical living. We also find in the New Testament it's freedom over evil powers. Coptic Christian Church, by the way, in Malden used to be in a small building a few years ago. I was actually coming up 385, and instead of taking the toll road because I'm frugal, Mary says it's cheap, but I'm frugal. Instead of taking the toll road, I went on straight and through Malden, and I'm driving along, and I look at this temple, and it's just Coptic Christian Church. And, yeah, they had built that for in just recent years. Not really at this point. But, you know, they are, but they do. But then we have other Christian denominations that, you know, venerate relics and pictures. And I still remember back in the 70s going into some African-American churches, and it looked like Billy Preston with his big afro, but it was a picture of Jesus in their tradition. And if you ask some of those folks, Jesus was black. No, he wasn't a wasp either. Yeah, at least olive, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, but so, you know, we've got all of these things, but we get freedom then, liberation from evil powers, or freedom. Powers that are hostile to God and which afflict humans with everything from physical disease to social ills to political oppression in the New Testament. And all of those things, in fact, a lot of diseases were attributed to evil powers that were out there. And Jesus' miracles and his exorcisms are seen both as victories over those powers, but they're also liberation to salvation. Jesus links every one of his healings, Jesus links to salvation and liberation. Not just healing from the demon or whatever disease, but he links it to spiritual things as well. And in the Gospel of Mark, well, the Synoptics as a whole, but in the Gospel of Mark especially, Jesus does not heal somebody to get them to believe. Jesus always heals somebody because they have come to him believing that he can do something, whether they fully understand or not. And so this liberating life in the Spirit because of Jesus' life, Jesus' power, and eventually based in the cross. In fact, in the New Testament, we also find that freedom from the power of death, especially in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, Christ's death destroys the one who has the power of death, and he delivers all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong bondage. In other words, the anxiety of death we get freed from. It's amazing. Studies have been done and have come out in the last few years. It's really kind of amazing. Do you know what kind of people generally spend the most money and the most effort trying to keep from dying when diseases strike them? People who claim to be Christian. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not looking to go anytime soon. You know, if the time comes, it happens. But it is. Folks who don't have, folks who don't have that kind of belief system tend not to be as, in general, not to be as determined that they're going to use every means available. Right. Oh, it is. Well, you know, and I constantly pray for doctors and nurses, and I pray that, you know, because I believe that God works through doctors and nurses. There are times that God can and does work beyond, but, you know, I think God works a lot through the doctors and the nurses. But you know, you mentioned Christian Scientists, Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in blood transfusions. Right. So we do that, but the freedom from the power of death really means freedom from the anxiety of death and the judgment that we associate with death. Yes. Yeah, well, we shouldn't. Right. Cast out fear. We shouldn't, but then again, in our humanness, in our fallen state, we are anxious. You know, and Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, talks about not being overly anxious. He said, which one of you, by being anxious, can add one cubit to his life? And you say, wait a minute, cubit and life, time, now it's the time to take one step. This is what he's saying. In fact, we know from experience that excessive worry and anxiety might actually shorten your steps, right? You know, people say, well, they got so mad they finally stroked out, which is kind of the thing that my systolic runs high in my family. And folks say, oh, you got, and who don't know anything, oh, you got to worry about heart. I said, no, that's stroke. Systolic is stroke risk. So don't make me too mad or I might stroke out on you. But no. We get that. But we have that fear. And perfect love casts out fear. And yet our love is part of that too is perfect love casts out fear and yet is our love perfect. And that's where the anxiety and the fear comes in. Yes, God is love and God's perfect love should cast out our fear. But our love for Him is not enough and is not perfect, and that's where our anxiety comes in. If we approach that perfection, you therefore must be perfect or mature, etc. And that is the thing toward which we go. But it's excessive anxiety, and what Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount is that excessive anxiety that comes and gets us. Charles Cosgrove writes, and I quote, "While believers live under the conditions of present earthly existence, they remain subject to the power of death as futility, but they are sustained by the life of Christ granted to them through the Spirit. Therefore, life in the Spirit is not liberation from death, but life against death, or life over against death." End of quote. So he said, you know, life in the Spirit doesn't mean that we're going to be liberated and not die. But rather it's life that's over and against death and over and against that fear of death. What? Right. It's freedom from the author of the Apocalypse, whoever that might have ultimately been. You're safe. Those are saved from the second death, which is spiritual death. So, yeah. Yeah. So, we also find it's freedom from law. Law pronounces judgment or curse and seals us in the power of sin. Christ liberates us from bondage to sin. Liberates us from bondage to sin. It liberates us from the oppression to sin and the oppression of sin. Even though those others, Ariel, Ukraine and Russia and their, because of their decisions, and we would, perhaps many would call them sinful decisions and greedy decisions, they're putting the people under oppression and they're fearful. At the same time, they don't have to be in bondage to that fear and the sin of those others. Sure, they may end up suffering consequences from those other sin, but they can be liberated from the bondage to that sin, just like you mentioned the Coptic Christians being beheaded and praying.
Well, I mean, Israel lived under oppression all their life. Think about it. All the countries that...
Oh, yes, and still want to dominate.
Yeah. I mean, they've been doing that for years. They're not Christians, yeah. Right?
No, but they are still part of God's people. If I bless you, if I could,
we are not reaching the people that need to be reached.
If I could determine ultimately what that was,
oh, no.
And bottle it.
No, let's don't bottle it. Let's just pour it out.
Or pour it out. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
But the thing is, what keeps me from doing it though is me, right? Self. That's what does it, and that's what holds us back. We are, in fact, more times than not, we're not oppressed. We're not in bondage to other. We're in bondage to our own selves, our own ideas.
We just don't want to upset the apple cart.
Right.
We just want to stay where we are and be comfortable and not change the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But some people can't do that.
That's true.
And I wonder, should I go back there where they are? I think I'd live very long, but I try it.
Should we just knock our fear down?
That's what he's trying to tell us to do. We can't help fear.
Well, the way I interpret that is that when they were being beheaded and they were praying, they were living in God's love, and they probably weren't fearful because they knew it was in God's hands. So puppet love cast out their fear. I see martyrs that way. I see like Joan of Arc that way. I see people who can actually be martyrs and be zealous in it. They have no fear because they're living in the power of God's love.
Right. Right, they are. They are, Susan. They're, and
how I feel, if you were really put on a thing and you knew between you and God and whoever was going to do whatever they were going to do, and you knew you were doing a martyr step because you were standing up and praying and testifying
right.
And doing what you were doing, I think the fear would go away. I don't
all
think you'd be okay.
Yeah, and Paul went, that's true. And Paul went through it over and over and over again and didn't know if he was going to live or die many times. And in fact, in Philippians, in 1 Thessalonians, he thinks the dead in Christ will be raised after second coming. Of course, he expects that to happen any time. And then by the time you get to Philippians, it hadn't happened yet. And he says, "You know, I don't know what I want to do. I might live and I might die. And I don't know which one I would choose. To live would be more fruitful service for Christ. But to die, that just might be far better because then I can go and be with Christ." And the Greek there gives an immediacy. It's not sit around in a holding cell and wait somewhere. It's immediately. Be there. And so, you know, he was ready and willing to do that because of that connection that he had. And at that point in time, he had lost a lot of the fear that he may have had earlier about all of that, which would then allow him to go on. Of course, he also believed at that point through, I think, progressive revelation that part of the Christian's reward, if they're faithful, part of the Christian's reward is to go immediately be with Christ at the point of death. Yes.
This to Evelyn this morning as we were leaving church as a sweetheart. You know, he
just once you truly realize each day when you wake up trying to pay it forward, meet in areas that church pastor says this church doesn't go, in other areas, we're paying it forward, and once we do, with all of our motivation, do this for the people, we start to use our motivation. Our class time, Jim, where he got to the point this past last year, he was defending himself so much because they were all just so pounding him. He finally says, "Well, I have my father's approval. We're one. You know, what you're saying to me, blasting everything, it's nothing anymore." So the truth, fear, love, our own father, motivated for the love of the human court, sacrificial love of others, it casts out fear. That's the perfect love in my sense of love is the perfect love.
That's the goal toward which we strive.
Yes.
And the motivation has to be there. And yet, when it came down to the end, even though he said, okay, whatever you want, there was fear there. Jesus was afraid to die. In the Garden of Gethsemane, 3 times he said, any other way. On the cross, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yes. He was talking to God the Father. No. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, or in Matthew, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. It's my God, my God. He was talking to God the Father. He wasn't talking to the crowd.
And are you sure he was
afraid of God? I think that there was, in his humanity, there was fear. But he ultimately makes a decision. With humanity. And were there not temptations? Was there not the temptation in the garden to decide otherwise, or the temptation on the cross to come down? Then it's all a sham. He doesn't have a clue. Temptation means that you must have the ability to choose right or wrong. And if Jesus didn't have the ability in his humanity, whether out in the desert or whether in the Garden of Gethsemane, to have said, enough, I'm not going to do it this way, then it wasn't a temptation. And he has no clue whatsoever. Ed? I mean, that's what he taught. And yes, there was a lot of pain in all of that. But at the same time, I think that in his humanity, if you take away that humanity, then you might as well be talking about the Gnostic Redeemer, the spirit man. I think that... Yeah, that's what the text says. And the text also says he was tempted in every way like we, yet he did not sin. So that's the perfection and freedom he tries to show us, that we are to strive to live instead of giving in. And we've run over. Yes, Jim? The longer I do it, the more questions I have. Yeah. But you know, it's, and the more I do this, the more questions I come up with, which means also the more that I want to know. But it's 10 to 7. We will pick up next Sunday night with week 7. God bless you. Go in peace.